11 a.m. So we want to welcome back Dr. Lakshin for part two on Parshanut and polemics. I guess the topic lends itself to dispute.
That's arguing. Right. That's so, right. We're asking for polemics when we...
Bakasha. Okay.
Yes. For those of you who are here in Israel, I'll wish you Chodesh Tov. It's Rosh Chodesh already here in Israel, and it will be for the rest of you very soon. And if it's Shvat, then that must mean that the winter is coming to an end, doesn't it? Tu B'Shvat is going to be here very soon. I'm going to share my screen with you. There we are. Just review a little bit now to begin with some of the questions that we raised last week. We're talking about the phenomenon of Jewish polemics against Christianity. And I quoted my teacher, David Berger, who said, in matters of exegetical detail, if you're looking at some commentary written by some Jew in whatever period, polemical motives are occasionally obvious, occasionally likely, and occasionally asserted implausibly. So sometimes it's really obvious that something is a polemic against Christianity, something written by a Jew is a polemic against Christianity. Sometimes it's possible, and sometimes people make these implausible assertions that the Jews are polemicizing against Christianity. And the more basic question that we didn't deal with last time, but I posed last time, was the question of how much did the classical rabbis and the medieval rabbis actually know about Christianity? In order to be looking for them, for examples of them polemicizing against Christianity, then we have to ask ourselves, well, did they really know what Christianity was all about? And particularly in the beginning of Christianity, when Christianity began as a very small and not very successful Jewish sect in the land of Israel in the beginning of the first century, Christianity started to become successful only after Paul took the message of Jesus to the Mediterranean world. And since it wasn't so much a phenomenon in Eretz Yisrael, Christianity was not a successful phenomenon in Eretz Yisrael, and certainly it wasn't a successful phenomenon in Babylonia, where the Babylonian Talmud was being written. There weren't very many Christians at all in Babylonia, and there weren't that many Christians in Talmudic times here in Eretz Yisrael. There were some, but it wasn't a very large group, at least in the beginning. So how much attention did the rabbis pay to Christianity? And a question that, and we'll think about that question a little bit today, and a question that we'll save to talk on talk about on other occasions. Did the rabbis actually see Christianity as an intellectual as opposed to a physical threat? That there were periods in history, certainly, where the rabbis understood Christianity as being a physical threat to the safety of Jews, but did they also see it as an intellectual threat? Was it something that they had to be polemicizing against? Okay, we're going to begin today by looking at two Talmudic texts that appear to be talking about Jesus and probably are talking about Jesus. We'll talk about the question after we study each of these texts. If we accept the text the way it is written in the Talmud, we have the rabbis saying something about Jesus, but they're saying some pretty surprising things about Jesus, as we shall see in these two Talmudic texts. I put in red here the part of the Talmudic text that is not found in the old censored manuscripts. Jews who lived in Christian countries cut away, or the censors cut away from the Talmud this passage, the part of the passage that is in red. And any Talmud that was printed in a Christian country after the invention of the printing press until the 20th century did not have this section in it. But we also have many Talmudic manuscripts from Muslim countries. And of course, there was no problem in a Muslim country writing things that were not complementary to Christianity. So the text survived in those manuscripts. Okay, I didn't give you an English translation of the text, but we'll walk through it slowly in the Hebrew and the Aramaic here, and I'll translate it as we go. So the text begins. This part is in black in front of you, and so that you will find in any standard Talmud in Tractate Sanhedrin, page 107b. Tanur Rabbanan, the rabbis taught, Lo'olam tehei simol docha v'yimin mekarevet. If you push somebody away with your left hand, you should also try to bring them closer to you with your right hand. So if you're chastising somebody, it's okay to chastise in certain circumstances, but you don't want to push somebody away too far. You have to find a gentle way of chastising. And of course, the understanding here is that most people are right-handed. And so if you're pushing somebody away with your left hand and you're bringing them close to you with your right hand, that means that the attempt to bring them close to you is the stronger attempt. And the Talmud continues, Lo ke'elisha shedechafo legechazi b'shtei adayim, not like what the prophet Elisha did in the beginning of the second book of Kings, when he was angry at his boy Friday, at his assistant Gehazi, and he pushed him away with two hands. And the Talmud goes on and describes the terrible things that happened when Elisha pushed Gehazi away with two hands, where he totally rejected him. The law, ki Yehoshua ben Prachya shedechafo Yeshua notzri b'shtei yadav. And also not like that story of Rabbi Yehoshua ben Prachya, who pushed away Jesus of Nazareth with two hands. In other words, he was too strict with Jesus of Nazareth. We'll talk about this, but first of all, we'll read through the text. Yehoshua ben Prachya Maihi. So the three dots there are, they tell the story of Elisha and Gehazi. You can go and read that in the Talmud if you're interested. That's not our topic here. What is the story, though, of Yehoshua ben Prachya? Kidekatlinu yanai malka lerabanan azal Yehoshua ben Prachya miyeshu la'Alexandria shel Mitzrayim. When King Alexander Yanai, who was a supporter, historians say, of the Sadducees, and so he started killing the rabbis who were Pharisees. He sided with the Sadducees in the conflict between the Sadducees and the Pharisees. The Sadducees and the Pharisees are two groups, rival groups of Jews here in Eretz Yisrael. In the first century before the Common Era and in the first century of the Common Era. So he was this Maccabean king, this Hasmonean king, Alexander Yanai, was killing rabbis. Azal Yehoshua ben Prachya v'yeshu la'Alexandria shel Mitzrayim. So Joshua ben Prachya and his student, Yeshu, went to, it doesn't say here a student, but from the continuation of the story, it is clear that Yeshu, Jesus, is the student of Yehoshua ben Prachya. They went to Alexandria in Egypt. Ki hava shlama shlach le Shimon ben Shetach. When the riots stop, when the massacres of rabbis stop, when it was safe to come back, Shimon ben Shetach, who was another rabbi, who was also one of the rabbi class, one of the Pharisees, Shimon ben Shetach sent a message to Yehoshua ben Parachia that it was safe to come back. The reason that Shimon ben Shetach did not have to run away to Alexandria is because he was King Yanai's brother-in-law. So he was able to stay in the land. It was he kind of assumed that his brother-in-law wouldn't kill him. But then when he saw that it was safe for the other rabbis to come back, he sent a message to Joshua and Parachia and Jesus that it was safe to come back to Eretz Israel. If I'll just point out for those of you who are following along in the original, most of this text here is in Aramaic and it is not in Hebrew. One of the ways of dating a text in the Talmud, it's hard to know precisely when any Talmudic text was written, but it's generally assumed that the older the text is, the more likely that the text will be written in Hebrew, and that if it's written in Aramaic, it's later. So later meaning perhaps like in the third century or perhaps later than that. Ki hava shlama, shlach le Shimon ben Shetach, when it was safe, Shimon ben Shetach said, and I left out the message that he sent, kam ata vidrame le hahu ushpiza. So Yehoshua ben Parachia and Yeshu, Jesus, got up and they started coming back from Egypt to Eretz Yisrael, and they happened upon a certain ushpiza. So the word ushpiza here, I think that in my understanding of this text, there's a kind of ambiguity here. The word ushpiza could just mean an inn, I-N-N, but it could also mean an innkeeper. So they came upon a certain ushpiza. Avdule yekara tuva. And in this inn, they gave quite a nice reception to Joshua ben Parachia and to Jesus. Amar. And so Joshua ben Parachia said to his student, he said, kama yafa achsanya zo. What a nice inn this is. What a nice hotel this is. But again, it is possible to understand that line as meaning, what a nice innkeeper, female innkeeper we have here. Amarle, Jesus said to him, Rabbi, eineha terutot. He turned to his teacher and he said, well, actually, the innkeeper, she's got crooked eyes or weak eyes or something. He says something insulting about the innkeeper. And it's possible that there's just a misunderstanding here, that Yeshu thought that his teacher was commenting on the beauty of the innkeeper when actually he was talking about the inn. And so he said, well, actually, I've seen more beautiful women than this. Amar le, Yehoshua said to him, Rasha, the chachata osek, that's a you evil person. You're worrying about something like this, about the about what her eyes looks like. Apik arba mea shipure v'shamte. He sounded 400 blasts of the shofar, and he put him into cheren for saying something like this. This is an overly strict, that's the theme here is, don't be an overly strict teacher. If your student misbehaves, don't be overly strict. And here's the example of Yehoshua ben Parachia being overly strict. Atalakame kama zimnin, a few times Jesus came to Yehoshua ben Parachia. Amar le kaplan, accept me back. You know, he came to apologize for this and allow me to come back and be your student. Lo have kamashkach, but he didn't pay any attention to him. He really wanted to punish him for this inappropriate comment. Yomachad, one day, have a kakari kriyat shma. One day, Yehoshua ben Parachia was in the middle of davening. He was reading the shma. Atal lekame, and Jesus walked in there, Yeshu walked in there, again, to ask to be reinstated as a student of Joshua ben Parachia. Savar lekabule, and Joshua ben Parachia said, you know, I've been hard enough on him, maybe I'll let him back in now, I'll accept him back. But since he was in the middle of davening, he made a gesture with them. Maybe he went like this, which in here in this country means just wait a minute. He tried to give him some gesture with his hand to tell him to wait until he finished davening. Hu savar, but Jesus thought, nidhadachile. He thought that his teacher was still angry at him, and he was giving him the signal, you know, get out of here. So, azal zakaf levinta vehishtachava la. So he went and he set up a statue and he bowed down to this statue. When his teacher saw this, Amarle, the teacher said to him, Hadarbacha, repent. Amarle, and Jesus answered him, Kach mekublani mimcha, but I can't repent. You have taught me, teacher, kol hachote umachti et harabim. There's a list. Rambam has a list in laws of tshuva and the laws of repentance of what people cannot do tshuva. And one of the ones on the list is anyone who sins and causes others to sin, as someone who leads a rebellion against Judaism or something like this, will not be given the opportunity to do tshuva. The amarmar, and we have learned, Yeshu kishef. Vehesit vehidiach et Yisrael. And since Jesus was guilty of sorcery and rebellion and causing others to leave the true path of Judaism, so because of this, I do not have the opportunity to return. And it all comes down to a story of an overly strict teacher who wanted to teach a lesson to a student and was too harsh with him. And then it all comes down to a misunderstanding when he gave him a hand signal, which he wanted the hand signal to mean, just wait for me for a minute. And Jesus understood this to mean get out of here. And that's how this whole thing began, according to this story. What connection does this story have with the historical truth about Jesus? Well, before we really answer that question, we have to say that in scholarly circles, in circles of New Testament studies, one of the most hotly debated topics is, like, who was the historical Jesus? What do we actually really know about the historical Jesus? Because there are contradictions between the various books in the New Testament. So what do we know for sure? There those people who feel that the historical Jesus must have been someone who had a strong connection to Shmirat Mitzvot, to the observance of the commandments, and others who saw him in very different ways, and some who see him as possibly have been strongly influenced by the Essenes who lived near the Dead Sea. All of this is controversial in scholarly circles. In this story here, are there any elements that actually sound like something that one might find in the New Testament? Yeah, there are elements here that have a certain overlap with some of the things that we find in the New Testament. I gave you two passages here from Matthew. An angel of the Lord appeared to Joseph in a dream. Get up, he said, take the child and his mother and escape to Egypt. Stay there until I tell you, for Herod is going to search for the child to kill him. This isn't about King Yanai, but this is King Herod who's going to be looking for the child to kill the child. So you should run away to Egypt. After Herod died, an angel of the Lord appeared in a dream to Joseph in Egypt and said, get up, take the child and his mother and go back to the land of Israel, for those who were trying to take the child's life are dead. there's an obvious allusion here in this passage in the New Testament to last week's Torah portion, Kimetu kol ha'anashim ha'mevakshim et nafshecha, when Moses is told that it's safe to go back to Egypt because those who are trying to take the child's life are dead. So we have, there is a story in the New Testament about Jesus as a child going to Egypt because it wasn't safe to be in Eretz Yisrael and then coming back to Eretz Yisrael. Okay, so that's one element in that story that can find some support in the New Testament. And the fact that at the end of that story, it says, Yeshu kishef vehisit vehidiyahi, Jesus was a sorcerer. This is a common claim that you can find in the New Testament, that the rabbis said that Jesus was practicing magic, was practicing black magic. I just gave you one of many examples from the New Testament, from the 12th chapter of Matthew. Then a blind and dumb demoniac was brought to him, and he healed him so that the dumb man spoke and saw, and all the people were amazed and said, can this be the son of David? Somebody can do something like this. This must be the son of David. But when the Pharisees heard it, when the rabbis heard it, they said, it is only by Baal Zavul, the prince of demon, that this man casts out demons. So the miracle working that is attributed to Jesus in the New Testament, it is made clear at a number of spots in the New Testament that the rabbis saw Jesus actually as practicing sorcery, magic, black magic, and that was their accusation. So those are two elements in this story that find like some support in the New Testament accounts of Jesus. However, some of you perhaps know, even before I say this, there's a giant problem with the story, which is that King Alexander Yanai died in the year 76 before the Common Era. And so this text, there are, I guess in theory, there are three possibilities about how to understand this, this text. Possibility number one, the rabbis don't even know when Jesus lived. The rabbis who wrote this story think that Jesus of Nazareth was a student of Yehoshua ben Prachya and who lived about 100 years before the Jesus that we know from the New Testament lived. That's possibility number one. Possibility number two is that, of course, there's a theoretical possibility that the New Testament is wrong and that all those sources are wrong. And actually, Jesus of Nazareth lived 100 years beforehand. I don't think that that's a very likely story. And the third possibility is that this story of the Talmud, this has been argued by a number of people. Some of them were arguing it just kind of to protect Judaism, but others, I think we're arguing, seriously believe that this story was about a different Jesus and that there were a lot of people named Jesus. That name Yeshua, Yeshu is just a short form of the name Yeshua. And Yeshua is the rabbinic Hebrew form of the word Yehoshua. There are a lot of rabbis named Yehoshua, a lot of Jews named Yehoshua. And 2,000 years ago, people used to slur a hey, the letter hey, when it appeared between vowels. And just like you would find particularly in sources from the land of Israel, Rabbi Yehuda is often referred to as Rabbi Yehuda. And even back in the Tanakh, Yehoram is sometimes known as Yoram, that hey drops out. And so Yehoshua becomes Yeshua. And we know that there were many people with that name, including the author of the book of Ben Sira, who is referred to as Yeshua Ben Sira, or Jesus Ben Sira. So there's the possibility, even though the text here says Yeshu HaNotzri, Shedechafo, Yeshu HaNotzri, but this theory says that originally the story was about some other guy named Yeshu, and then some copyists later on misunderstood and thought that the Yeshu was actually Jesus of Nazareth, and so he wrote in the he wrote in Hanotzri into the text. Each of you can choose which of these explanations of the disparity between this text and what we know about Jesus from the New Testament to follow. I'll tell you that I am inclined to just believe that the rabbis did not know a lot about Jesus of Nazareth, and that there's a garbled story here, and there's a story about him living 100 years before the time that he actually lived. And the story has just turned into a cautionary tale about how to be a good teacher and what to do when you have a student who does not behave in the way that you want a student to behave. Okay, that's text number one that we're looking at from the Talmud. And now we're going to look at another text from the Talmud that, again, you see the black and you see the red in the standard copies of Talmuds that were printed in Christian countries before the end of the 20th century. You'll only find the black part of the text. And in manuscripts from Sephardic countries and in some recently printed Talmuds, you'll find the text in the red. The Talmud in Sanhedrin is talking about somebody who's on trial in a capital case. The Mishnah says, Matzulos chut betaruhu, if they found some reason to, even after they'd convicted somebody of a crime and sentenced him to die, if new evidence is brought, you always open up a capital case until the last moment. So if somebody rushes into the court and says, I've got something to say in defense of this person who's being taken out to be executed, you listen to the argument. And if they found that there was an argument in that person's defense, then they would let him go free. The imlav, yatsali sakel. And if after listening to all the arguments that are offered about why the person should be let off, they said there's no merit for any of these arguments, they would take him out to be killed by stoning. Uchruz yotzei lefanav. And when he was being taken out from the court to the place where he would be stoned, there would be an announcement that would be made. Ish ploni ben ploni yotze lisakel al sha'avar avera plonit. So-and-so, the son of so-and-so, is being taken out to be killed by stoning because he committed such and such a capital offense. Ufloni ufloni edav. And the witnesses who testify.
No sound.
Okay, I was wondering if it was just me or okay. Well, hopefully we'll get back soon. Rabbi?
Oh.
Okay, we lost it for about 20 seconds. With the last 20 seconds or so, we didn't have sound.
Okay. How far did I get through the Mishnah? Can you hear me now?
Yeah, you said basically the last minute somebody can come and will accept the evidence at the last moment. And then I'm not sure the following sentence you said.
Okay. And they made it was being
gone again.
And who the witnesses were was also being made clear so that somebody could come and.
Okay, we keep losing you, but he probably can't hear us while I say this. Okay.
Do you know that you're lost?
I'm sure he doesn't, but we'll let him know. Or maybe he does know.
Put it in the chat to him.
Yeah. I don't know if he'll see it, but fine. I'll
let him know.
Are you back?
I understand that there are still problems. Can you hear me now?
Now we can hear you. Now we can hear you.
Okay. Well, I'm going to continue, and Rabbi Kelman, just interrupt me anytime that the sound stops, please. Okay.
Excuse me. So, do you think you could just go back over that last sentence again, because we didn't quite get it?
Sure. Every effort is being made to save the person who's being taken away to be executed, and that even as they're taking him away to be executed, they're making an announcement about which crime he committed and who the witnesses were, so that if somebody could come and testify that he didn't commit that crime, or those witnesses aren't kosher witnesses, or they weren't there that day, anything possible could be done in order to try to save him. Okay, the Gemara says about this, well, from reading the Mishnah, we see that the Mishnah says, "Kruz yotze lefanav," that an announcement was made as he was being taken off to be executed. To which the Talmud says, "Lefanav in meikara lo." That means that you make this announcement only when he is being taken off to be executed, but you don't make the announcement beforehand. You don't go looking beforehand, making these announcements, there's a capital crime going on here beforehand. And then the Talmud says, "V'hatanya," but we actually learned of a case where they did make the announcement ahead of time. And what was the case? Be'erev ha-Pesach t'la'uhu l'yeshu ha-Notzri. On the eve of Passover, they hanged or impaled, or maybe even crucified, Jesus of Nazareth. V'ha-Kruz yotze lefanav 40 yom kodem shehu yotze lisakel al shekishef v'heisit v'hidiach et Yisrael. Kol Mishiode, okay, when they hanged Jesus, before that, for 40 days, they were making an announcement saying, Jesus is going out to be stoned. It's shifted from hanging him to stoning him, but actually hanging in the rabbinic system is something that's done after somebody is stoned. It's not a way of putting somebody to death. It's a way of displaying the body for a short time after the person has been killed in another method. So an announcement was made for 40 days that he is going out to be stoned because shekishef v'hisit v'hidiach et Yisrael, the same phrase that we saw in the last Talmudic test, because he was a sorcerer who misled Jews through the sorcery that he performed. Kol mi sheyodea lo zchut yavo v'yelamed alav. And the announcement was made, if anybody knows anything that can be said in defense of Jesus of Nazareth, should come and should speak in his defense.
Sorry, sir. Can I ask, where do you read this? Is it in the text?
Yes, it's in the text here. I'm just reading through the text and translating the text.
Which line, please? Because I'm not able to follow.
Okay. I was reading the fourth last line here. Kol mi sheyodea lo zchut yavo v'yelamed alav. Anybody who knows something to say in his defense should come and testify in his defense. V'lo matzu lo zchut, but nobody came, or if anybody came, they didn't have any arguments with any merit. U'tela'uhu be'erav.
Please,
maybe
if you're
a
pointer, that will help
you follow. Right. Just what they're saying, you can, if you highlight what you're reading, if people will be able to see it, right.
I'm not so sure that it's all that easy for me to highlight it in this.
It's fine. Just use your cursor.
Yes. That's okay, fine. I'll just use the cursor. Right. U'tela'uhu be'erev ha-Pesach. And then they hanged him on the eve of the Passover. Okay, so that's the text that they quote, that's they quote it as a braita, b'hatanya. This is like this old text. And this is in Hebrew, actually, not in Aramaic. So that seems to be a sign that this is an older text here about Jesus. And then and the only reason they quote this is because the Mishnah said that an announcement is made about somebody who's being taken out to be executed just as the person is being taken out to be executed, but not beforehand. And this text seems to suggest that for 40 days beforehand, you make such an announcement. To which Ula objects. Amar Ula, the Tizbara, does this make any sense? Does this text make any sense? Bar Hafuchi Zchutu, that they'd be looking to say something in defense of Jesus of Nazareth. Nesitu, he is somebody who misleads and causes people to worship idolatry. That's a category of it's called the Mesit. And there's a rule that says, Verachmanamar, and the Torah taught us, Lo tachmol ve lo techaselav. You're not supposed to, according to Talmudic understanding, some of the rules of due process are suspended when you're dealing with a mesit, with somebody who's such a grave danger to the people because he's causing people to worship idols. In a situation like this, you wouldn't. So this text doesn't make any sense that they would be doing this for 40 days for somebody like this. And then they answer, Ella, Shane Yeshu, the case of Jesus is different. De Karov la Malchut Hava. Because he had connections with the government. The rulers looked upon him favorably, and so he had to be given this special treatment of waiting for 40 days before he could be executed. Okay, there's a lot to say about this text, but before we say all of the problems that this text has, I'll just show you. This is a very old Yemenite Talmudic manuscript where you can see this section is here. And it's interesting that whoever the copyist was in Yemen thought that this line was a very important line, and he wrote it in bigger letters. You see the kind of bold, larger letters in the middle of the text where it says, on the eve of Passover, they hanged Yeshu HaNotzri, Jesus of Nazareth. And they even spelt Yeshu here with an ayin, which Jews don't generally do, but that is the proper way of spelling Jesus' name in Hebrew. So before we talk about all the problems in this text, just point out that there is one opinion in the Gospel of John that Jesus was actually executed on the eve of Passover. There's a conflict between what it says in Matthew, Mark, and Luke. In Matthew, Mark, and Luke, it's very clear that the Last Supper, the night before Jesus was killed, was the Seder night, and so that has him being killed on the first day of Passover. But in the Gospel of John, you see in verse 14 here, it was the day of the preparation of the Passover, and it was about noon. In other words, John is saying this because he wants Jesus to be the Korban Pesach. The Korban Pesach, the Paschal sacrifice, is offered on the eve of Passover at about noon. And so John emphasizes the fact that the crucifixion is taking place on the eve of Passover. Okay, so that one fact, in quotation marks, about Jesus is reflected in this text. But this is a totally amazing text, totally shocking text, because the text here is suggesting that Jesus was put to death by the rabbis through a process of a trial that was conducted by Jews and not by the Romans. And even in the New Testament texts that apply a lot of blame to the Jews for the crucifixion, it's never suggested in the New Testament that the rabbis actually were the ones who executed Jesus. And in fact, it seems very clear that by the 30s of the first century, there was no capital punishment being administered by a Jewish court in the land of Israel. And the only capital punishment that was being administered by a court in the land of Israel was from the Romans who were occupying the country. And that as I said, even in the worst of the gospel accounts, the Jews only bear indirect responsibility for encouraging the Romans to execute him. But you know, this text is suggesting that there was a Jewish process, a Jewish trial that took place, a Jewish Sanhedrin that put him on trial and executed him. And then the last line of the text is can really blow your mind here. The line that says, Shani Yeshu, the case of Jesus was different because he was close to the Romans. He had connections with the Romans. And we have no reason at all to believe that was the case. So what's happening here? I guess, again, it's possible that this text is talking about somebody else, and not, even though it says Yeshua Notzri, and even though in that old Yemenite manuscript it clearly says Yeshua Notzri, maybe it's somebody else's case that is being described here. Or I think that this is yet another example that the rabbis did not know very much about the story of Jesus of Nazareth. And they did know, and the rabbis who are putting this text together are putting this text together at a time when, A, the Jews are being blamed widely for being responsible for the crucifixion. And so they say, oh, okay, I guess we were responsible for the crucifixion. I guess we must have killed him. And also, I would also argue that this text is presumably being put together at a time, perhaps in the fourth century or later, once the Romans adopt Christianity as the religion, the official religion of the Roman Empire. It is only at that point that a line like the last line here, Shani Yeshu, the Karov L'Malchuta, but the case of Jesus was different because he had connections with the Romans. Starting at the end of the fourth century, there was a union between the church and the Romans, but all historical evidence shows that the Romans were no fans of Christianity in the first couple of centuries of the existence of Christianity. That's an understatement that they were no fans of Christianity. So we have two Talmudic texts here that I think the major thing that they demonstrate to us is that the rabbis had not great set of knowledge about the beginnings of Christianity. And perhaps because it wasn't, when the phenomenon of Christianity began, it wasn't such a big thing in Eretz Israel. And so the rabbis just didn't know that much about it. And then they came to believe various things that they heard that the Jews had actually been responsible for the crucifixion, and various things that they saw that the Christians and the Romans were buddies. Okay, so now we'll go back to the theme of finding polemics in the Talmud after now establishing that the rabbis had spotty knowledge about Christianity. So let's try one example here of one text that it has been argued, and I think it might be a reasonable argument to say that this text might have a polemic against Christianity, an argument against Christianity. The Mishnah at the end of Kiddushin says, Rabbi Meir says, Here I gave you English translations. A person should always teach his son a clean and easy profession. Just for those of you who are in Toronto, I'll tell you a story from many years ago. A friend of mine was studying for his PhD in Jewish studies, and he was taking smicha exams with Rabbi Gedalia Felder, Zichrono Libracha, the wonderful, great rabbi who was in Toronto for many years, the Talmid Chacham of Canada for many years. And my friend told me that Rabbi Felder one time said to him, "So, I know that you're studying for a PhD and you're taking smicha exams. What do you want to do in life? Do you want to be a rabbi of the community or do you want to be a professor?" And my friend said to him, and it was true, he said, I want to be a rabbi of the community. To which Rabbi Felder said, "Oh, you want to be the rabbi of a shul?" He says, "Why don't you be like Lakshin? Become a professor. It's an omnus nikia vikala. It's a clean and easy profession," is what I can't look at this text without thinking of this line from Rav Felder. Anyways, Rabbi Nahorai says, just to save time, we'll just read it in English here. Those of you who can follow the Hebrew can read it in the Hebrew. "I leave aside all professions in the world." The Mishnah in Kiddushin does talk about how it's important to teach a profession to your children. But Rabbi Nahorai says, "I leave aside all the professions in the world and I teach my son only Torah. For a person eats of its reward in this world and the principle endures in the world to come. And all other professions are not so. When a person comes into sickness or into old age or into suffering and is not able to be involved in his work, he dies in hunger. But the Torah is not so, but rather it guards him from all evil in his youth and it gives him a goal and hope in his old age." Similarly, it says concerning Abraham, our father, peace be upon him. And Abraham was old and God blessed Abraham in everything. And we find that Abraham, our father, that Abraham Avinu performed the whole entire Torah before it had been given. As it says, "Because Abraham listened to my voice and kept my safekeeping, my commandments, my statutes, and teachings." So this is an unusual ending. The Mishnah really should have ended with just saying, if they wanted to give the last word to Rabbi Nahorai, who says that the most important thing is to teach your children Torah, because that will help them throughout their entire life. And then it could finish with the quotation about Abraham, that God blessed Abraham in everything. But then we find thrown in here, almost as an addition here, we find, of course, that Abraham Avinu observed the entire Torah even before it had been given, as it says, "By reason that Abraham listened to my voice and kept my safekeeping, my commandments, my statutes, and my teaching." Why are they emphasizing, why did this Midrash develop that Abraham observed the entire Torah, this anachronistic Midrash that says that Abraham observed the Torah before the Torah was given? So it has been argued, and I think it's not a bad argument. I'm not going to, I don't have time. I'll send out the slides and anybody who wants to can see how the text is a little different in the Parma manuscript, an excellent old manuscript of the Mishnah, but I'm not going to go into that now. In Romans, in the New Testament, Paul says, "What then shall we say that Abraham, our forefather, according to the flesh, discovered in this matter? If, in fact, Abraham was justified by works, he had something to boast about, but not before God. But what does Scripture say? Abraham believed God, and it was credited to him as righteousness. V'he'emin b'Hashem v'yachshaveh halot tzedakah." Now, to the one who works, wages are not credited as a gift, but as an obligation. Paul is actually talking here about the word tzedakah here, that God was like doing a favor to Abraham here by accepting him. But if he had been observing mitzvot, it wouldn't be a tzedakah, it would be something that he earned. However, to the one who does not work but trusts God, who justifies the ungodly, their faith is credited as righteousness. And Paul goes on, is this blessedness only for the circumcised or also for the uncircumcised? We have been saying that Abraham's faith was credited to him as righteousness. Under what circumstances was it credited? Was it after he was circumcised or before he was circumcised? It was not after, but it was before. That's in the 15th chapter of Bereshit, Paul says, even before he was commanded about Brit Milah. You see that you can become a tzaddik, that you can become righteous without any mitzvot. And he received circumcision as a sign, a seal of the righteousness that he had by faith while he was still uncircumcised. I think that it's a common argument, and I think it's a reasonable argument to say that there are kind of warring interpretations about Abraham, with Paul arguing that Abraham is the knight of faith, the person who became righteous only through faith, and that's what it means when it says here, "V'hemin b'Hashem v'yachsheveha lo tzedakah." It's only based on his emunah. It is only based on his belief in God that he became a tzaddik, that he became considered righteous, and the rabbis, maybe they've heard that argument. And then, if they've heard that argument, then they say, actually, Avraham Avinu observed the entire Torah. And we know that it's anachronistic to say this. He observed the entire Torah even before it was given. The idea that if Abraham's going to be our role model and our Judaism centers around Shmirat Mitzvot, the observance of Mitzvot, then it makes sense that Abraham should be somebody who observed who observed the Mitzvot. So is it certain that this text here in Kiddushin is an anti-Christian polemic? By no means. It's not in the obvious or certain category, but it's in the possible category. And just for a last thing, I'll just point out that despite the fact that you find a Talmudic text like this, you'll find other Talmudic texts that are perfectly happy in saying something wonderful about faith. Like Rabbi Simlai, 3rd century in Eretz Yisrael, taught that there were 613 mitzvot. And then King David came and he reduced them to 11 principles, as it says, a Psalm of David, Lord, who shall sojourn in your tabernacle, who shall dwell upon your sacred mountain, he who walks wholeheartedly, the Dover Tzedek, and then list off 11 characteristics. And then Rabbi Simlai's teaching here finishes with, Habakkuk came and reduced them to one principle, as it is stated, but the righteous person shall live by his faith. Okay, if Rabbi Simlai was worried about Christian teachings and knew that the Christians were saying that Shmirat Mitzvot isn't important and that the only thing that is important is faith, would Rabbi Simlai have given this teaching and said that actually what it comes down to is just one thing and that the only thing that matters is emunah? I find that unlikely. So I think my conclusion from this is that Christianity was not uppermost in the minds of all of the rabbis of the Mishnah and the Talmud by any means. It was not, but that there are some hints that here and there, like the end of the Mishnah here, that maybe they know what. Maybe the author of this these lines here in the Mishnah knows what the Christians are teaching about faith and Abraham, and basing their teaching, Paul talks not just in that passage in Romans, but in many passages in the New Testament. He talks about Abraham being the model for this new understanding of Judaism, new understanding of the worship of God. Okay, I'm going to stop here to leave some time for questions from the chat. Rabbi Kelman, do you want to pass them on to me?
Just before I start, I did notice before some people were commenting, and I just want to, as I guess the administrator here to say a policy. We do encourage people to put questions in chat. I agree that that's how we learn. That's how we go. Some people are saying it bothers them, it disturbs them. So you can turn off your chat box if it does. But I do want to say, as a Torah Motion policy, we do very much encourage people to put questions in the chat. And if you find it confusing, then just turn off your chat box. So that's just to make that clear. Thank you. I don't mean to get anybody upset off for a bit, but I do want to, that we do encourage that. Okay. You have at the beginning a couple questions, I guess, challenging your claim that Christianity was not common in Israel and in Babel. Ellen pointing out that there's a book showing zillions of monasteries in the region, and pointing out that Jewish-Christian relations were seen as a threat already in the time of the Churban Bar Kokhba revolt. So maybe, I don't know if you want to address that. And of course, Rabbi Gamliel Vilamashinim is assumed to be against the Christians. That's already the second century, but want to comment on that.
Right. Okay. So obviously they did know about Christians, and in some ways they were worried about the Christians. And I'm not certain that Vilam al-Shinim is only about the Christians. It's about sectarians, but it's also about the Christians. I don't think that there were all that many monasteries in Eretz Yisrael back in Talmudic times. Later on, certainly there were, and I don't think that it was a terribly successful movement in Eretz Yisrael. That's my understanding.
Okay, somebody was just asking, why would the Christians censor the Gemara that the Jews killed, Jesus?
Last week, I already said that sometimes the censors do not show a lot of sense in their censoring. But at a certain point in the Middle Ages, it became a common Christian argument that the Jews were maligning Jesus in their holy texts. And censors then just went through and they found any kind of comment that might be about Jesus or might be about Christians, and they started erasing them without any particular sense to the erasures. And sometimes Jews did the erasing themselves for self-preservation.
Okay. Ruth pointing out again that the story about the Amin, Mekarev and Smol Docha, again, placing sort of the whole, what happened in history on one little event. But for those who were at the shir yesterday, that I want to thank Dr. Lakshin, who introduced me to Dr. Schwartz. One comma, you heard what one comma can do. So and that is a common thing in the Gemara. We had it yesterday by Kamsa and Bar Kamsa, that even if the Gemara is not necessarily, the Gemara is not necessarily historically saying this is the only cause, but the Gemara is pointing out, we know in life, little things can lead to big consequences. One star, one little event is what triggers things. It's there and you need the explosion. Anyway, so and if you can comment on that, if you want to add that.
I agree with your comment. And they're not trying to make a statement about Jesus. They're trying to actually teach somebody what it's like to be a teacher. When you're a teacher, this is what you do when you're a teacher, that you shouldn't be overly, it's just an excuse for teaching us teachers what it is that we should be, how we should be relating to students who fall a little bit short.
I think there was a question, now I don't see it. Did he get better treatment, sort of it being Karov L'Malchut? Somehow, how did that, perhaps? Karov L'Malchut, Jesus was a relative of David HaMelech. I doubt that's what it means, no? Or it might have mean that.
That he was Karov L'Malchut to
a descendant of royalty. Yes. Is that possible?
Yeah. I've heard people making that suggestion. I just don't find that that the phrase Karov L'Malchut means that in standardly in rabbinic literature.
Okay, I don't know if I want to really to bring this up, but I will mention, and I don't get a few people I guess are very sensitive to the term of New Testament versus the Gospels. And I don't think anybody who uses the term New Testament, and I occasionally use it, means it to replace the Old Testament. That may be how the Christians use it, and that's perhaps why people get upset. But these Gospels, right. I know that it's so different. That's what its term's called. I don't know if you want to comment, and maybe I'm, but I just pointing that out. Figured out.
Yes. Well, I'll tell you the truth. I always try to avoid using the term Old Testament, which I definitely find offensive. I have tried to. Some people suggest that the proper term to use for what the Christians call the New Testament is early Christian literature. And in fact, I even had a non-Jewish colleague at York who put out a book. It was an introduction to what most Christians call the New Testament. And he called it Introduction to Early Christian Literature, since he didn't want to be using a title that somebody might find offensive. And it was really nice that he did that. But I find that early Christian literature isn't a really great term, because there's a lot of early Christian literature. The church fathers are really early too. We're going to be seeing some church fathers very soon. Next week, we're going to be seeing some church fathers. That's early Christian literature. And so there's a section, there's a group of books that the Christians put together and the Christians call the New Testament. And you can't call them the Gospels, because only the first four books in there are the Gospels. And then there are all the, I guess you could call them the Gospels and the letters and the other writings, but it's very clumsy. So I find that the only term, I apologize to anybody who was offended by the term, but it's the only term that I have found that it conveys the books that are in this volume that I've got here. For anybody who wants to read these early Christian books, this is one of the best ways to study them, in this book called The Jewish Annotated New Testament that my friend, Professor Mark Brettler, put together this collection where they're Jewish, to help Jews understand the New Testament and show how various things in the New Testament relate to various teachings of Judaism and are opposed to or drawn from or connected with things in Judaism. That's a fine collection. So I have not found a non-clumsy term to replace the New Testament.
A couple of people suggested Christian Bible. I'm just
Christian Bible. Now, the Christian Bible also includes Genesis and Exodus and things like that. That's in the Christian Bible too. I guess you could call it the last part of the Christian Bible. Okay. I'll think about that.
In many ways, words are what you mean them to word, and different people coming from different perspectives are going to interpret words differently. But okay, right. we'll leave it at that. I just find your story on Rabbi Felder, who, of course, all in Toronto. I mean, our family had a very close personal. I don't know if you know, he lived in my father's home when he came to Toronto. He taught my father Hilchot Tefillin, and he was very close to my uncle, you know, who spoke at his funeral. Our family is very close to Rabbi Felder, but it's a little bit of the grass is greener on the other side. You know, it's hard to say that I don't think academics will tell you that academia is color. You know, like everybody looks. So it's a rabbi. What do you want to be a rabbi? The Nourish guy you got to put up with. But, you know, everybody. So I think it's an even cuter story than you had meant to be. Yeah, all this and all of life, it's hard to find the Kalev and the Kiyan, especially in today's world with this. For those who don't live in Israel, especially, you got to pay for day school tuition, got to get a job, whatever. That's a whole other story. Anyways, okay. I think someone was just asking, how old was, you know, Jesus in that story in Sanhedrin when they pushed him away? Yeah, I mean, obviously, I don't think there's any way of knowing, but.
Right. There's no way of knowing. Last week, I mentioned that Christians generally say that Jesus' mission began when he was 30 years old. And so if you wanted to connect that together with what Christians say about Jesus' mission, then I guess he wouldn't have been such a young man, according to that understanding. But it's anachronistic. This is taking place before the death of King Alexander Yanai, who died in 76 BCE.